From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, the 28th of July, 2020, and we thank you very much for joining our program this morning. Going to have an interesting lineup of conversations today. We're going to start out with Secretary of State Jim Condos talking about the fact that we have a primary coming up on August 11th. The state is urging folks to vote by mail. Ballots went out a week or two ago, and people are being urged to fill them out and get them back in if you want to participate in that primary upcoming August 11th. Some interesting races for instance, the Democratic gubernatorial nomination and lieutenant gubernatorial nomination, and as well as some competition on the Republican side for both of those offices. And you'll be voting, if you could vote by mail, that saves folks lining up at the polls on Election Day, where social distancing is going to be an issue. So something to think about there. In the second half hour of the program, we're going to be speaking with Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. We want to get an update from her on where things stand with the COVID-19 virus and how Vermont's response is going. There's been a big resurgence nationally and really serious problems with the virus in other parts of the country. Worries that there may be slight upticks in parts of Vermont. We'll see what's shaping up in the second half hour of the program. Hoping to talk to one of our CBS News correspondents just after the mid-show break, and then we'll be having what I think will be an interesting conversation. Former Vermont State Rep. Job Tate has reached out to me on Facebook multiple times over in recent months and has urged me to be thinking about people being unkind or even maybe it rises to the level of persecution almost in some areas toward Christians, particularly conservative Christians in America. Are conservative Christians being persecuted in the United States? That's the question up for discussion in the second hour of the program. Job Tate will be joining us, as well as Middlebury College religion professor James Calvin Davis. He's graciously agreed to join us as well. So that should be a very interesting conversation in the second hour of the program today. But let's start right in with Secretary of State Jim Condos, who I believe is on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good, and you?
No major complaints. We are going to have a little primary upcoming early August,
and you think?
That's what I hear. And we got these big envelopes in the mail a couple of weeks ago from our in Montpelier, so we got them from the city clerk there, and they kind of hung around the house for a while, and finally I said to myself, my wife's always way more organized and proactive than I am. She filled hers out probably a week and a half ago or something. I finally said to myself yesterday, you know, if I'm gonna have a radio show segment tomorrow morning with the Secretary of State, telling everybody they need to fill out their ballots and get them in the mail, I should probably do that myself. So I went ahead yesterday afternoon and got that little chore taken care of. But what are you hearing out there? How are people doing? Are they coming in as fast as you hoped?
Let me give you some numbers to update you. As of yesterday afternoon around 3 o'clock, we had a total absentee request of 132,100. Hmm. And if you go back to total votes cast, both absentee, early, and in person, in 2018 we had 107,000, and in 2016 we had 120,000. So just based on the absentee request for this year, we're already past both of those numbers. We also, if you combine both 2018 and 2016 primaries combined, we had just under 40,000 total absentee ballot requests. And so, you know, we're at least, we're more than three times the total of the last two election cycles. And coming back in, so far we've got just under 40,000 that have been returned. And if you look at the same time period in August of 18 and August of 16, it totaled about 19,000. So we're well ahead of where we were. And we're putting a big push right now to tell people to please don't wait till the last minute. They can if they want, but if they do, they're going to need to either drop it off at the clerk's office by close of business on the day before the election, or bring it to the polls and drop it off there. I would recommend giving yourself, if you're going to mail it back in, giving at least 7 days notice, or 7 days in the post box, because you just don't, you know, with the mail, even though it takes, it will get delivered, but it could be delayed, and we just want to be careful.
Yeah, so, and you refreshed my memory, too. There was a postcard that went out to households around Vermont a few weeks prior to the mail-in ballots themselves, and basically with that postcard, you were invited to request a mail-in ballot, right?
That is correct.
And so...
We sent that to all active registered voters, and then we sent a separate postcard to anybody that's on the list that's considered a challenged voter. In other words, they have not affirmed their address as yet.
Okay, and so the responses you got to the postcards, how many of those came in?
Well, we don't know that. The clerks process those at their individual offices, so we are not aware right now how many of those were changed. We may, after the fact, be able to pull that data, but obviously, with just the sheer number that we're getting, we know that it's worked.
Now, if you didn't mail in that postcard saying, please send me an absentee ballot, you didn't get an absentee ballot, right?
Unless you called up and requested it or emailed. The postcard was just a reminder as such.
Mm-hmm.
You still had the ability to walk into your clerk's office and request an absentee ballot. You could email them. You could call them. You could actually go on the My Voter page on our website and order it via, that's how I did it. I wanted to test the my voter page, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my ballot sent to me here in Montpelier like 3 days after I requested it. So, you know, that worked. But the closer we get to the election, the more time you need to give for both. If you're requesting it to come to you, you may have to go pick it up because you may not have much time to turn it around and get it back in.
So as of yesterday afternoon, we had, how many was it, about 40,000 votes in, shall we say?
Well, we had 40,000, yes, 40,000, just under 40,000, like 39,900 that have been returned so far. I'm sure that number's probably higher already this morning. That was as of 3 o'clock yesterday.
Okay. And... midsummer primaries historically have not been Vermont's strongest performance in terms of turnout. Typically, what is the turnout for an August primary in Vermont?
So I think you'll find this across the country. Generally, the statewide primaries do not generate a lot, because if you think about what a primary is, it's really a nominating process for a particular political party.
Right.
Now, here in Vermont, we do not have party registration, but in many states, they do have party registration, and that limits it even more so. And then you have other factors, like how many contested races, what contested races, in the case this year, we have on both the Republican and Democratic sides, we have contested races in the governor's race and lieutenant governor's race. But then again, you look at Chittenden County, and they've got a very contested state senate race going on. So all these things help drive the actual request for ballot. Typically, a primary in Vermont has been about 20% to 25% highest. For a primary, and we have about 480,000 people listed on our voter checklist, and we're now at 132,000, and that's not done. That's just as of yesterday.
Okay, so the 40,000 that you've seen so far, they're just under 40,000, I guess, as of yesterday afternoon. Would you call that encouraging, discouraging about what you expected, or where? How should people kind of should we give it a yay or a boo?
I think it's encouraging. I mean, if you think about, like I said, the total at the same time period, the total for 2018 for returns at this point was 7,000, and in 2016 was almost 12,000. So a combined total of about 19 for the two races, and we're already at 39.9.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's considerably larger, although really it's been a concerted effort by your office and by the town and city clerks around Vermont to get this out there and get this in front of people, the postcards, and then follow it on with the absentee ballots themselves. Are you hearing that the ballots are coming in correctly, or it's a fairly... You got to pay attention while you're filling out your ballot and getting the various items into the right envelopes and so on. Are many of them coming in? How shall we say, kind of messed up, or are they coming in clean and proper?
The vast majority. It's almost unanimous. I mean, there are some that come in that are what we call defective ballots where they didn't follow the rules right.
Mm-hmm.
And let me clarify. You do have to make sure that you put your voted ballot into the voted envelope. You have to fill out the certificate side of it with your name and address and date and sign it. And then you have to take your two ballots that you did not vote and put those in the unvoted envelope. And they're clearly marked. And every clerk... they all provide their own instruction sheet with it, but the ones I've seen are very clear as to what they have to do. So if people would just take their time, fill out and follow the process that is laid out by the town clerk, it should be not an issue at all. It's pretty simple.
All right. Hey, we have a listener on the line calling in, Dick from Middlesex. Good morning, Dick.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, I think he's kind of alluding to the news. Channel 3, I believe it was, or 5 or something, said something about there was a certain percentage of votes that are disqualified, probably for not filling it out properly, like he just told you.
Mm-hmm.
Does he have any handle on how many of those are?
That's a good question, Dick. Secretary of State Jim Condos, do you know how many ballots so far have been disqualified out of the nearly 40,000?
It's very early for us to be able to tell that. The clerks have to document this into the system.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say that generally in our races here in Vermont, what we've seen is 1% or less. That are misidentified or misqualified in the process. So it's pretty low, and that's much lower than the national average. So the national average is much higher. It's like 3 to 5% in some places.
Hmm.
Right. One more question.
Yep. Sure, Dick.
I was wondering, as long as it's the mail. It was mentioned earlier. The mail may be a little slow. No bad feelings towards the U.S. Post Office. Just happens. If they come in after the election day, they're not counted. Is there going to be any tension of that, or
no? That is not. It's in state law that the. Ballots must be received by the town clerk at the polling location by 7 p.m. on election night. Anything after that is not counted. But again, we have very few of those. I can't give you a number because I don't have one, but we have very few of those that occur. Most people are considerate enough to make sure they get it in. And we're being cautious because sometimes people will say, well, I dropped it in the mailbox last night. Yeah, but the mail probably doesn't get picked up till late this afternoon or something. So, you may have missed last night's pickup, and today it won't get picked up till late. So you lose a whole day right there alone. And
right.
the way the mail system in Vermont works now is that it all goes to the processing center, I think in two locations, I believe, Burlington or Essex and White River Junction, and then the mail's processed and then sent back out. I think it's first of all, let me just clearly state that our postal workers are hardworking and they do an amazing job. And really think about it. You can drop a piece of mail in the mailbox, today, and 3 or 4 days from now, it'll arrive at its destination in San Francisco. So I think that in general, the Postal Service does an excellent job. They've been stymied by actions in Congress, which I think really hopefully will be addressed, not only funding wise, but also in legislatures and Congress should not get into the weeds on how a business is run. What they should do is provide the resources and the goals of what they want to accomplish. And then let the experts deal with the how it's done. I'll just say it again, the postal workers are some of the hardest working workers out there that we have, and they do an excellent job at what they do. I do take issue with people who think the Postal Service needs to be run like a business. Yes, it needs to be run like a business, but we all have to remember it is a public service. It provides a service to America, and the whole goal of in fact, many like FedEx and UPS, they don't go to every address in the state, whereas the Postal Service is required to go to every address.
I wanted to ask Secretary Kondos, this is a sort of a dress rehearsal maybe for the November election, right? We're going to try the same technique then?
And obviously the postcards were actually designed to help us help the town clerks clean up their checklist. People will say, well, there's dead people. The people that died received those cards. That's true. And we're hoping that those people will turn around, the people in that household will turn around and send that back and say this person is deceased or this person's moved, whatever. And that's the whole idea, is to try to get this thing cleaned up. As we've said for years, people have a tendency, they remember to go to DMV to change their address on their driver's license, but they don't go to their town clerk. They often do not go to the town clerk to change their address for voting purposes. And that's critical. And sometimes they won't, if they do go to a new town clerk, let's say you move from one city to another within Vermont, and you go to that town clerk, one of the questions they ask on the form is, are you a registered voter in another town? And if you didn't answer it, then they would not know. Now, to that premise, we have in our new state-of-the-art election management system, when a town clerk goes to input a new registered voter, if they're registered somewhere else in Vermont, there'll be a pop-up message to that town clerk telling them this person's registered in another town, and then that clerk can then message with a click of the mouse can message that town and tell them to remove them. But records of deaths, if you die in Florida or you die in New Hampshire or New York State or wherever, it may take time to get back here. I will say that dead people generally do not vote, and it's important to remember that dead people don't vote. There are occasions where someone has voted early and then passed away before the election, and it appears that a dead person voted, but that's not the case. They voted legitimately. Their vote counts just as much as anybody else's.
Well, I suppose that would be something to think about. If you are in the, do you think you're in the final days of your life, you might want to vote early just to get the vote done before you leave this earth or something. I don't know, but that would be one approach for a small number of people, I would suspect. And I'm wondering if you have any sense of the way of Vermonters. Are you getting any pushback? I guess is one question. Are you getting any people coming to you and saying this vote by mail system is not going to work well, and who are worried about it? And what do you tell them?
Sure, we get feedback all the time from many people There was a lot of town clerks that originally did not support the concept, but have come around on that. The vast majority of town clerks currently do. We believe that the vast majority of Vermonters do, and I think just if you look at the absentee request, you know, we've got over 132,000 people who have requested absentee vote by mail ballots. So we think that it is being accepted. Keep in mind, Dave, across this country, there are five states currently that use what we call universal vote by mail on a regular basis. Those five states are Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Utah, and Hawaii. You know, this is not a partisan issue. Utah has a Republican legislature, both House and Senate, and a Republican governor. And they embrace and support fully vote by mail. And if you look around the country, even these days with COVID, many of the states have expanded their vote by mail. You know, some states, California has gone full vote by mail as we are going for the general election. New Jersey is sending ballots to everyone. So there are many states, even Republican states in the South, are increasing the number of people who can vote by mail. This is something that is simple, safe, and secure, and it allows people to vote at their leisure. It allows people to sit at their kitchen table, and they can pull up their computer, their laptop, whatever, and check positions of different candidates, and then decide whether they want to vote. They don't have to vote in a 2-minute window. They can vote over 20 minutes or 2 hours or 2 days, whatever it is, and they can take their time with it. So I think it's becoming more accepted. Even President Trump and Vice President Pence have used vote by mail. Our military has used vote by mail since the Civil War. So this is something that is really, it's not really vastly different. It's just at this time it's different. And for instance, here in Vermont, the process we're using, the only thing that changes really is the fact that we're sending a ballot to every registered voter, active registered voter in the general election. That's the only thing. The option is still up to the voter whether they want to use that option or not.
We are about out of time, and I appreciate you taking the time with us this morning, Secretary of State Jim Kondos. Thank you very much, and we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
You're quite welcome, David, anytime. Just a reminder to everyone, your vote is your voice.
Your vote is your voice. All right, Secretary of State Jim Kondos. We are fast approaching the bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. Stay with us. We're going to be talking with Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Commissioner of Health, getting an update on the coronavirus in Vermont in just a couple minutes, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we're going to be speaking, I think, very shortly with the Deputy Commissioner of Health for the state of Vermont, Tracy Dolan, getting an update on where things stand with the coronavirus in Vermont. She is not with us quite yet, but we are hoping that she'll be with us very shortly. And meanwhile, I'm just wondering, there are always plenty of stuff to talk about. Attorney General William Barr is going in front of the Congress today and is reported to be telling folks he's going to take a defiant stance in defense of President Trump. He's going to be talking about the Justice Department's recent moves to lessen or remove criminal penalties for some of Trump's associates. And let's see, the Washington Post is reporting on all of this. Attorney General Barr heading up to Capitol Hill. The Post says he will tell the House Judiciary Committee today that President Trump has not improperly intervened in the Justice Department business. even though Barr has more than once moved in criminal cases to help the president's allies. And Barr will defend the administration's response to civil unrest in the country, according to a copy of his opening statement. Barr, according to the statement, will take a defiant posture as he testifies before the panel for the first time since Democrats took control of it, alleging they have attempted to discredit him since he vowed to investigate the 2016 FBI probe of possible coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign. He's going to complain that the media have been unfair in covering the unrest around the country. Of course, that's been a big issue in the last few days because the federal government has been sending in unidentifiable troops or law enforcement personnel or somebody into places like Portland, Oregon, and now Seattle, Washington. The president's talking about doing this in other cities as well, where there are reports that protesters are being rounded up and put into unmarked vans and taken to places where folks don't at least initially know where. And that doesn't really sound like a typical law enforcement operation in the United States of America. But Barr is expected to face critical questioning on his response to anti-police brutality protests across the nation, his controversial intervention in high-profile cases like those involving Roger Stone and many other matters. And so it's going to be a very interesting, I think, hearing today on in front of the House Judiciary Committee. Hey, I do think we have now Tracy Dolan, Deputy Commissioner of Health for the state of Vermont, on the phone with us. And good morning, Tracy. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. And you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
That's good. So I wanted to check in with you and just sort of get an update on where things are. I think a lot of people in Vermont are nervously looking at our low numbers and worried that they're going to start rising again just because of what is happening, I think, elsewhere in the country. What are you seeing and hearing and knowing out there?
Sure. That sounds good. So we are in a good place in Vermont. There's no doubt about that. Our incidence continues to remain low. We have a few new cases, you know, every other day, some days none, some days, you know, four or five, two or three. And overall, our number of people in the hospital remains very low. At times, we may have one person in the hospital. I'm not sure how many we have today. I'll pull that up while I'm chatting with you. But overall, you know, our testing is high, our positivity rate is low, and so we are somewhat unique in the country. There's very few other states like us, and it feels very good. The challenge is, of course, keeping this. The reason it's like this is because of the behaviors that we are doing. It's not because we're better people or that we have some sort of special immunities, because everyone's doing the right thing. People stayed home. People are wearing masks. People are going to their doctor when they feel sick. People are getting tested when they need to. They're washing hands. They're doing all the right things. And they're social distancing. And so that is great news. But the way we maintain this is we really continue these behaviors all the way through until we get a vaccine. And that's really how we do this. And so people are a little bit nervous, especially with summertime and people coming in and out, although still we haven't seen a huge surge, even though we've had people coming in and out over the summer, and we're well into July now. So the other concern is colleges. Some concern there with people coming in from out of state, but we have a fairly robust system that we have in place. And then, of course, the other concern is back to school, which I'm happy to chat about as well.
Sure. In fact, let's take these sort of one at a time. Let's focus on the higher ed at first. And about the colleges, what are the colleges in general doing, and how can you allay concerns about, oh my word, there's going to be a whole bunch of UVM students coming in from, you know, Long Island or New Jersey or Massachusetts or places where they have a lot of COVID, and are we going to be seeing a big surge in Burlington because of that?
Sure. The colleges are taking this very seriously. I'd say that first. And they are as concerned as anyone, of course. I mean, it's in their best interest in every way to be protecting their students, to ensuring that they have the right systems in place. So they're doing a lot. They are educating in advance. They're sending out a lot of information to parents and families to say, this is what we expect when you get here. You're going to be signing a contract. This is what we expect before you arrive. This is the testing that we're going to do when you arrive. This is the testing we're going to do again on day 7. This is how we're going to do classrooms. They're going to be spacing people in classrooms. There's going to be some remote learning. Depending on the college, they may mix that up. There's going to be some colleges that allow you to live on residence, but they're bringing those numbers down in some cases. They have plans on what to do if there's a positive. You know, the Department of Health will assist in contact tracing there, and we will try to manage any cluster outbreak if it happens. So there's a lot of education. They're getting their plans in place with different laboratories for doing testing. Some folks are going to do testing just on what we've required, which is when students arrive and 7 days later. Some colleges will do testing throughout the year. Either way is fine. We've recommended, you know, that minimum, and then some may go beyond that. But I think they're doing everything they can, and it's a little bit of a wait and see. But they're doing everything they can before students arrive. And, of course, health screening as well on campus, so that they're going to be checking student symptoms as well.
You mentioned contracts that students will be expected to sign. These are new in response to the COVID-19 crisis?
Yes, these are new behavioral contracts around health, contracts that talk about I won't be holding or going to parties, that I will practice distancing, that you know, that I will be getting the testing done, that if I'm a close contact, I will comply with the directions, et cetera. So the health contracts are really meant to hammer home these messages.
Wow. And so if students violate these terms, let's say they go to a party, you know, or a party sort of spontaneously develops and they're seen there or whatever, are the colleges planning some kind of consequence for that, or what's the drill?
Yes. So we speak to the colleges every week. So I spoke to the colleges this morning. There are several colleges who've said those students will be removed. They're not playing games. Others have said they may have a suspension, you know, so I think it will depend on the college and depend on the consequence, but they're not taking this lightly. I know there are some colleges who say if you violate the contract, you're done. You can learn remotely and you're leaving.
Wow.
Yeah, they're nervous, you know, and rightly so. We want to keep things the way they are as much as we can here. And you know what? I don't know exactly what to expect, but I am hopeful. And it will be a great thing in the fall if we see things moving forward and we're keeping our numbers the way they are. So far, we've had some good luck. You know, we've had summer camps going. Those have been going well. People are paying attention there. So far, our travel has been going well with tourists coming in and out. Our numbers have stayed relatively low. So far, the little bit of opening we're doing is not resulting in any kind of significant spike.
Now, if someone has, say, family coming for a visit or wanting to come for a visit from out of town, and I think we've talked a little bit about this before, but and a lot of times these visits are for 2 or 3 days or something. You know, it's a long weekend or whatever. I suspect Labor Day is going to be one of those that typically has, you know, family reunions and last big cookout of the summer. And how do you balance the short term nature of that visit with this request for a 14-day quarantine?
So if somebody's coming from a place that requires them to quarantine when they get here, then they have to quarantine when they get here, which would mean they could not mix with others. They could not go to the barbecue. They would have to stay inside.
I see. Okay. Let's say the barbecue is going to be, you know, right on the property, or even maybe the porch. I mean, if somebody has a screened-in porch,
yes,
they're going to be eating.
They can go onto their porch with their family. They cannot mix with others.
Huh. Okay. And if they are, let's say they're flying into Burlington, right? They're coming in from Arizona, for instance, and they're going to,
yes,
they want to go to this family reunion. Is there any kind of screening at the airport as they get off the plane or whatever?
No, but I would highly advise any family here who has relatives in Arizona not to be inviting them to come and visit right now.
Yeah, yeah.
any of the states that are going through an outbreak. I mean, it's absolutely putting you and your family at risk. It's putting anyone, of course, elderly at risk. If you're coming from a hot spot, don't come and visit right now. Not advised.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, unless you're coming to visit to house sit by yourself, But assuming that you're coming to visit and you're going to be in holiday mode and you're going to want to go out and mingle with other people inside of the home you're in.
That's sort of the point of it usually.
Yeah, it's ill-advised.
Wow, that's too bad. I mean, that is a really tough pill, I think, for a lot of people to swallow, you know, not just here, but everywhere, I would think, when you know, you may have a long history of annual family gatherings on...
Yeah, it's a different year. We're skipping them.
Yeah.
it's a brutal disease if it hits you the wrong way. Brutal disease.
Wanted to shift our attention, if I could, Tracy, to the school systems in Vermont. Obviously, they are on the cusp of trying to get a school year off the ground here, and they're trying to figure out sort of what's in and what's out. And what do you see and hear on that front?
Sure. I'm sorry. Were you referring to the K through 12 schools?
Yes.
Yes. So I think the governor will actually be announcing a start date today, which will be helpful for folks. But you know, here at the health department, we're feeling. You know, we know that there's tons of concern from parents, from teachers, from superintendents about school starting. But in the big scheme of things, Vermont's incidence and prevalence is low. And we are looking at a lot of other countries, especially smaller European countries that have opened, who have similar rates to Vermont, and they have not had outbreaks in the schools. And so we feel like with the population, which is relatively low risk, so far the data shows that children are not as likely to transmit, even if they do have it. And with some of the mitigations that you can put in place at the school, some of the distancing, certainly the masks at school, et cetera, we feel like based on what we're seeing in other countries now, that this is a relatively safe move. We'll monitor closely, but we are comfortable with schools opening. I know that there's a lot of concern from teachers and from others, and I know that some of the schools are going to do a hybrid of remote and in-person. But we are feeling pretty good about our recommendation. We're not feeling good about the concerns people have, but from a public health perspective, we're feeling good about the recommendation to open schools, especially for younger children. They absolutely need the socialization. And here in Vermont, it appears to be a safe choice.
You know, one thing about opening schools, which here's an approach that struck me as kind of interesting. I read about it in the Times Argus this morning. The city of Montpelier, this is a school system there. It's actually a combined district now with the town of Roxbury. The Montpelier-Roxbury School District is talking about, I mean, they're asking parents to basically make a choice. Do you want your kid to be in school, or do you want your kid to be being educated by something they're calling a virtual academy, which I gather means basically online?
Yeah.
And you make a choice now, you know, before the start of the school year, and you stick with it for the balance of the fall anyway. I don't know if this accounts for spring semester as well, but what do you think about that, about just kind of bifurcating things according to parents' preferences that way?
I mean, I think schools are doing everything they can. It's very difficult to tell parents, even if you're very uncomfortable, send your child to school. I mean, that's not an easy thing. So I think we have to be reasonable. But I really do hope that parents are taking a good look at the rationale behind school opening. I hope they're looking at some of the data that we've shared in other places outside of the U.S. that have tried this. You know, the other thing is the population going to school here are Vermonters. It's a little different than colleges or the tourist situation where you have a lot of different people mixing, especially from places that might have higher rates. This is a Vermont population. What I would ask is that before school starts, people are really careful and make sure that they are limiting contact with others and really being thoughtful so that we have the healthiest population we can as school begins.
And talk to me a little bit about the effects on kind of the school day routine or whatever. I mean, you know, I think the reference point is always kind of what went on before, and what went on before was kids pouring off buses and getting dropped off by parents and kind of pouring into a school building on the average morning. I gather that there are going to be temperature checks and that kind of thing now?
Yeah, there will be screenings. I think some of them can be done at home by parents. Some of them might be done at the school. That's going to be up to the school districts to determine where they want to do the screenings. I think that they're also encouraging parents, if possible, to drop their kids off at school so we can have fewer kids on the bus. I think they're going to be spreading out the busing. And then again, you know, picking certain days. I believe the pediatricians in Vermont, through the Vermont chapter, have just put out a note really encouraging schools to think about full day, full week in class learning for younger children up to fifth grade, because our numbers are so very, very low there.
Mm-hmm.
But for others, you know, even applying more caution might make sense. But yeah, the busing will be a challenge for sure, so I think they're really asking parents to think about that. And then the in-classroom learning, you know, they're trying to think about how they keep them spread out, which might be part of why they can't have everyone there at the same time. So we're encouraging that where in-class learning can happen, that we prioritize the special needs kids. Unless they have medical conditions, that might make them more vulnerable, and so that is a priority. So again, I can't tell you for sure what schools are doing, but that is one priority. I have a daughter who has some learning challenges and who does not do as well with remote. And so I'm excited for the days that she will be in school and will be hoping if I have options to get her there more. So that's there. Recess, as far as I know, will be happening. Kids will be able to go outside. And in fact, we want them outside more. And so we will be encouraging that. Gym class inside will be a challenge, but we will really be encouraging some outside options for gym. They may have some inside options as well, but getting kids outside will be a priority, and that will continue. I think the other question was...
basically had to do with parents' schedules, work schedules around school schedules and all that.
Yeah, it's hard. Now, a lot of people aren't working their regular jobs anyway right now, so a lot of parents have had to make that adjustment. I think a lot of employers are going to continue to try to give flexibility, but that may not happen in every case. This will be hard, there's no doubt about it. It will be hard if you're working and your kids are at home. It'll be hard if you're working at home and your kids are at home. That's one of the reasons we're also encouraging kids up to fifth grade to go into school. We know that they're way lower risk. We know it's safer for them. We know it's better for them. And we know that 10 and under, it's also better for them to be in a school environment, certainly where their parents are working. Kids may have more unsupervised time, and that will be challenging too. I know that employers are getting as flexible as they can about their staff working from home, but obviously that doesn't work in many cases.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, you know, in the case of the older kids, let's say middle school and high school, it sounds like that's an easier population to do distance learning. Is that what you're hearing as well?
In some regard, although I don't know about you, but even for me, and I'm a grown-up, it's actually pretty hard to stay motivated all day alone at home. And so even kids in middle school and high school, it's hard. So I'm really glad the hybrid is happening for a lot of schools, because I think that'll be a good touch base for them. But that is a challenge, and for parents as well, to go away and leave your kid at home all day where they can just kind of hang out and do whatever is one thing. To go away and leave your kid at home all day with the expectation that they're going to stay motivated, not everyone does. So it will be challenging, no doubt, but we are in a very extreme situation right now where we're going to be doing things that are not the norm, and we're going to make the very best of it.
All right. Well, Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always really informative, and I appreciate the update.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. We are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And let's see here. Oh, I should give you a reminder about the news conference coming up just after 11 o'clock with the governor. Other top state officials are going to be broadcast live here, as we have been on WDEV. They're every Tuesday and Friday now lately with the governor and people like Commissioner of Health Mark Levine and Mike Pichak, the Commissioner of Financial Regulation, and other state officials who are managing the COVID-19 crisis and its response here in Vermont. And we also want to mention our podcast. Don't forget, if you miss part of our broadcast here, we're live weekdays between 9 and 11 a.m. And we welcome as many people as can listening during those hours. But if you miss some of it, you want to get caught up, you can always go to wdevradio.com And you can check out our podcast by just clicking on the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a little bit when you get there, and you'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest. And by later today, you should see the fact there that we have been talking with Tracy Dolan, the Vermont Deputy Commissioner of Health. So let's do the CBS News Top of the Hour report. When we come back, we'll begin having one of our individual conversations with one of the CBS News correspondents. And then we're going to have a conversation about the question, are Christians being persecuted in America? We'll be back, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour here on this Tuesday morning, July the 28th, 2020. And we've had this odd phenomenon recently of federal agents pouring into places like Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and elsewhere per order of the president. He says they want to restore order to cities that have been unable to restore order themselves. Some folks are saying that what's really going on in these cities are some protests still of folks who are upset about police brutality, particularly against non-white people, and that the protests. I saw the mayor of Seattle, I believe it was last night, on the on television saying she supports the idea of these protests. She thinks they're important, and this is the way change sometimes happens in America. Federal agents, on the other hand, have been heading into these cities and basically being pretty tough about enforcing against the protesters. Want to bring in Paul Vialis, a law enforcement analyst with CBS News, to talk to us about what is going on out there. And Paul, what are you seeing and hearing on all this? Paul Vialis, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Dave.
Thanks for joining me. What are you seeing and hearing about these protests and the federal agents pouring into some of our cities?
Well, I can tell you, Dave, that what we need to understand is that there are two different things going on, and we're kind of lumping everything into the middle, which is not good. But what you see in Portland is the federal government's legal responsibility to protect federal property vis-a-vis the courthouse. And that's been part of the U.S. Marshal Service since its inception over a couple hundred years ago. So that's nothing new. That's just an example of local leadership failing to protect its community. So they have to do that. As far as federal agents going to other cities, federal agents have to be invited by the municipality in order to go there. They can't just go there, even though we've been hearing a lot of rhetoric that's saying, that the agents are just dropping in and they're taking over. It's just not the case. The local municipality, so for example, in Chicago, Mayor Lightfoot had to invite federal agents to come and collaborate with local law enforcement for a very specific scope of work. That is exactly the truth of what's happening. So if they're not invited, they don't come. Even though the president has made the invitation, that's just not how it works.
Were they invited to Portland?
Again, they do not have to be invited to Portland because they are there by federal authority to protect the courthouse. Since its inception, the U.S. Marshal Service has been doing this. The only time they have to come in there, in this case, is when local authorities, such as the mayor, fails to exercise the proper due care to protect the physical, financial, and human assets of that community, which they have failed to do, hence leaving the responsibility to the Marshal Service to go in and do it. Now, the Marshal Service has now had individuals and agents from Homeland Security, as well as Border Patrol, that are trained in riot control, that have come to assist them on this, which they clearly can do as well. So this is not a stretch. It's not the Gestapo techniques that people are throwing out there, which is a spewing hate, and it's blatantly inaccurate.
The mayor of Seattle was on television last night, one of the cable shows. I'm not sure. I was flipping around between a few of them, but She was saying that she does not want to see federal agents coming to Seattle. Do you know if they are there or are they on their way? Are they going to Seattle despite the mayor's wishes?
They cannot go there unless they're invited. So if the mayor chooses to do that, that's the mayor's responsibility. The mayor has a bigger problem than that. I mean, their city council passed an ordinance called Crowd Control Tool, which goes into effect this weekend, and the ordinance bans Seattle police officers the use of lethal tools, including pepper spray, in order to quell a violent riot. So basically, the Seattle police chief wrote a letter saying, be expecting an adjusted deployment because we're not going to put our officers in the line of danger. So what you're about to see in Seattle is unprecedented in the history of this country. And God only knows what's going to happen now because clearly, you know, the inmates are going to be running the asylum in that city.
And is there a sense that people are getting the word here that that's a place they could go and take advantage of the situation if they so desire?
I don't understand the question. Who would take advantage of what?
Say some of the more violent elements among the protesters might say, hey, it looks like the police have been ordered to stand down in Seattle. Let's go there and really, you know, muck things up.
Oh, that's a given. I mean, it's already happening. It's been happening across the country. You know, we have fueled this sense of entitlement that people can do whatever they want, destroy public property because they're trying to make a point, when in fact protests have been hijacked by rioters. And now you've got this group, NFAC, that started in Atlanta, just soldiered into Louisville, Kentucky. And you're going to continue to see them float around. And you've got black militia, you've got white militia, and you have a reduction in the police force around the country. So, Dave, what do you think that spells in the days and weeks to come? Nothing positive, I can assure you of that.
The mayors of six cities are appealing to Congress to make it illegal for the federal government to deploy militarized federal agents to cities that don't want them. What do you make of this legislation that's pending in Congress now?
Dave, I don't really understand the legislation, and the reason for that is because the laws and rules already exist, as I've said. They have to be invited. The president came on television, and bear in mind, I am apolitical, so I don't care who's sitting in the Oval Office. But the president came on several times and has said, you know, we're waiting to be invited. We're ready and willing to go and help. The other part is federal law enforcement has been collaborating with local law enforcement for at least the last 40 years of my career that I'm aware of. So this is nothing new, Dave. This is something that goes on constantly. So I don't know why with all this grandstanding and politicizing about new legislation, it already exists. They can't go unless they're invited.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that Congress said, hey, or any legislature, I've seen this at the state level too, where there appears to be a sudden problem that's particularly one that's getting a lot of media attention, and lawmakers say, what do we do? Oh, we make laws. Let's go make one.
Yeah, they need to start. You know what? Honestly, Dave, I think our elected officials need to start, you know, being more concerned with doing their job than keeping their job. I think that would be a good start for them.
All right. Well, Paul Vialis, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. CBS News.
My pleasure, sir.
Law enforcement.
Have a wonderful day, Dave.
Okay. Thanks a lot. We've got an interesting conversation lined up, I think, here. Job Tate is a former Vermont state representative from down in Rutland County, and I'll get the exact town from Job in just a moment to refresh my memory on that. He has reached out to me on Facebook a few times over the course of the last year or more, really, to talk about his concern that that Christians, particularly conservative Christians in the United States of America these days, are not being treated very well, and that you know, some of this stuff actually borders on persecution and maybe heading in that direction, etc. We're going to be talking about that with Job Tate. Also joining us on the call here is James Calvin Davis. He is a professor of religion at Middlebury College, and these are both first-time guests on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And gentlemen, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Good morning. Do we have Job Tate with us?
Job Tate is here. It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks you for joining me, Job. And Professor Davis, what about you? Are you there?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. Okay, Job Tate, I'd like to get the sort of the problem statement from you. What is the issue that people should be concerned about vis-a-vis treatment of Christians, and particularly conservative Christians or evangelical Christians in the United States of America these days?
Well, that's an excellent question, Dave. And I think for me, and I draw a lot of my ideas on this from my time serving in the Vermont State Legislature. And I think what we are seeing now, in not just in Vermont but across the nation, is a highly increased level of hostility towards not just people of faith necessarily, but people who practice that faith. And we see more and more in legislation and in the way that people in power sort of manage expectations around that legislation, I just see a mounting hostility towards people of faith. Now, your listeners should know, Dave, you and I are friends on a little bit of a superficial level, but we are friends on Facebook.
Yep.
And over the years, you and I have gotten into it quite a bit. We've had some back and forth. And I remember in particular, you can cut me off here at any point, but I remember
sure.
in particular about a little over a year ago, you and I got into it over this issue about when there was the attack on the Easter worshipers. You remember this?
Yep.
And we saw on Twitter, President Obama and Secretary Clinton going out of their way to describe them as Easter worshipers and not as Christians. And this is an attempt, I believe, a coordinated attempt to sort of cancel out Christians, make it feel as though they aren't being persecuted at all, to allow the persecution or the hostility to go unabated.
Let me ask Professor James Calvin Davis from Middlebury College what you think about this sort of first round here, Professor. And this was a horrific bombing, series of bombings in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday, 2019. 267 people were killed. A couple of Islamic terrorist groups claimed responsibility for these attacks. And there was an outpouring of a whole lot of different leaders around the world, and past leaders, future leaders, etc., tweeting and making other sorts of statements and so on. And two tweets came, one came from Hillary Clinton, one came from Barack Obama, and they both used the phrase Easter worshipers to describe who the victims were of these attacks. And this generated quite a bit of debate and really controversy on places like Fox News and Breitbart and other conservative media. In particular, National Review weighed in, Washington Examiner or Washington Times, I think, and they were basically complaining that there was a some kind of a concerted effort on the part of Mrs. Clinton and former President Obama to avoid the word Christians in these tweets, and that they're and that they use the word Easter worshiper, the words Easter worshipers instead, and folks on these media outlets seem to find this quite insulting, as did our friend Job Tate here. Do you think this was a concerted effort on the part of Obama and Clinton, as Job Tate was just saying?
It's a good question, and I think it's not inconceivable that there were political reasons that. That I'm not aware of, that they might have, that might have shaped their language. I will admit that I'm skeptical that it was meant as an intentional slight to Christian worshipers for a couple of reasons. One is that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama themselves are self-identifying Christians, but also the term Easter worshipers from a Christian perspective is not necessarily derogative or inaccurate at all. Many of us who identify with the Christian tradition refer to ourselves as Easter people, as a way of talking about the centrality of Easter. So I'm inclined to think that more was made of that episode than really needed to be.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting to me how there was this this real, I don't want to say a concerted effort, even by, you know, Fox and Breitbart and National Review and Washington Times and all these other outlets, but it did sort of become, a talking point over a couple of days, where, you know, Laura Ingraham's on Fox News and Breitbart is talking about this, and it almost seemed to me, and this is sad to say, but it seemed as though they were more outraged by a couple of tweets coming from Hillary Clinton and from Barack Obama than they were about the bombings of 267 human beings over in Sri Lanka. At least that's the way the coverage seemed to come across. I don't know. What do you think about that, Job Tate?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I've been a Christian for 40 years, and that was the first time I'd ever heard the term Easter worshipers used to describe a group of Christians. You know, we've been known as Christians for over 2,000 years. You don't need to invent a term. You know, it was interesting, a year prior to the tragedies in Sri Lanka, there was the tragedy in New Zealand, where, you know, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama again tweeted, as they should, their objection to the tragedy. But they referred to those victims as Muslims. And they said, you know, these were Muslim victims who were worshiping. And I just think, to me, if you're politically sensitive to this type of effort to make it seem like, you know, it's interesting. Doctor said, you know, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama identify as Christians. And I think sometimes now, more and more, in the circles that they operate in, that's a negative. I think that they would want to go out of their way to say, you know, we're not covering down for Christians here. We're covering down for Easter worshipers. To me, it looked a little too coordinated, and I thought that made it newsworthy. I don't know if the doctor agrees or not, but
Professor James Calvin Davis, do you think that the way the media, at least from what we've been telling you so far, I don't know if you made a study of this at the time or whatever, but the coverage of this, in particularly in the conservative media in the United States, did you have any thoughts at the time about it, or do you have any thoughts now that you're hearing sort of what the flavor was?
On the one hand, like I said before, I think this particular episode is being hyper-interpreted as something more hostile than it was likely intended to be. On the other hand, it doesn't totally surprise me, because it fits into a larger concern that many evangelicals have in this country, and frankly, though I don't agree with all of the concerns, they are understandable. The concern being that that they are losing the culture, in a sense, that Christianity is no longer enjoys the position of comfort and dominance that it once did. And as Mr. Tate said, especially in some circles, I do have experienced a certain amount of even hostility, especially in Vermont, in the time that I've been in Vermont, and I've been here for 20 years, over hostility towards those who, and assumptions about those who identify as Christian. So there is this narrative that Christians are kind of under assault and losing the culture. But I do think this is an example of the way that narrative is stretched maybe beyond persuasiveness.
Job Tate, in the case of the phrase Easter worshipers, do you know of any other religions aside from Christianity in the world that celebrate Easter?
Well, there are some religions that surround Easter. Passover, that's a religious time, of course, but Easter is where we celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Right.
So in my mind, it's a Christian holiday. That, you know, Christianity takes on a lot of forms, particularly Catholicism and Protestantism, but
I was just going to say, the reason I'm asking is because, so if somebody refers to Easter worshipers, and we don't know of any other religions in the world that celebrate Easter as Christians do, shouldn't we assume that they're talking about Christians?
Well, if you use the term, let's say, for instance, there was an unfortunate incident, and we referred to somebody as Ramadan worshippers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would spark your curiosity or raise your antenna and just say, well, why wouldn't you just call them Muslims?
It actually wouldn't. I'm sorry to say. I've crafted a lot of phrases in my life in news stories as a longtime reporter for the Associated Press, and generally you're writing really fast and you're trying to get the story done, and you are trying maybe not to repeat phrases time and again in the story because that gets kind of boring for readers, and so there are other little standards like that, but. I would frankly think nothing of typing Ramadan worshipers in a case.
Let me interject.
Go ahead.
Because you have to remember why these people claimed responsibility
mm-hmm.
for these attacks. The reason that they claimed responsibility wasn't because they were upset about Easter necessarily in particular.
Yeah.
They were upset because they were Christian. And that was a particularly potent and emotional time to strike Christians, for sure. It was opportunistic to use Easter to do so. They had a lot of people gathered together. But the reason that they did it is not that they had a problem with Easter. They had a problem with them being Christian. And so when you say that, when the byline is Easter worshipers were attacked, that misses the point. Christians were attacked because they were Christians, and they're Christians 365 days a year. If they had been attacked on Tuesday, you wouldn't have called them Tuesday worshipers. They're Christians.
Right.
And so...
By the way, I had to note here that there were many statements and tweets coming out from, as I mentioned, from luminaries around the world objecting to this horrific attack and series of attacks on Easter Sunday 2019 in Sri Lanka. Here, I'll read you a tweet here. It did not come in for any criticism that I heard from Fox or Breitbart or National Review or any of the other conservative media. This tweet says, 138 people have been killed in Sri Lanka, with more than 600 badly injured in a terrorist attack on churches and hotels. The United States offers heartfelt condolences to the great people of Sri Lanka. We stand ready to help. The word Christians does not appear in there. The word Easter doesn't even appear in there, so you couldn't really make that connection between what holiday was being celebrated and the fact that people who are going to be worshiping on Easter typically are Christian. That tweet came in for zero criticism that I could find from Laura Ingraham or from the National Review or from Breitbart, etc. Any guesses as to who wrote that tweet? Professor Davis?
No, I don't.
What about you, Job?
No idea.
No, it was written by one Donald J. Trump, president of the United States. That was actually his second tweet of the day. His first tweet said that there were millions who had been killed in Sri Lanka. He had to correct that. But the second tweet of the day, 138 people have been killed in Sri Lanka, with more than 600 badly injured in a terrorist attack on churches and hotels. The United States offers heartfelt condolences to the great people of Sri Lanka. We stand ready to help. Well, no mention there, as I said, of Easter or Christians, I guess that was okay because he's the president of the United States or something.
Well, I'd be interested, Dave. I'd be interested to know the timeline where that tweet came out, if it came out before or after they had all the intelligence, all the information about the attacks, and if people had claimed responsibility yet or otherwise. I'm not defending the president, but the point is, if by omitting Christians, he did mention churches, of course,
yeah,
which is different from synagogues and mosques. But by omitting Christians, he at least didn't call them by something different.
Hey, I hate to interrupt here because this is a good conversation, but I gotta go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll continue our conversation on the other side with Job Tate and with Professor James Calvin Davis of Middlebury College. We'll be back, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. practicing all safe protocols, masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we're going to be, we are continuing our conversation with Professor James Calvin Davis of Middlebury College. He teaches religious studies there and related topics. And Job Tate is a former Vermont State representative, a conservative Christian, and one who has expressed concern to me, mainly via Facebook, about the persecution or the sort of discrimination, prejudice, I guess, against Christians in the United States these days. I want to ask Professor Davis if I could. We have this, I think what is an unusual phenomenon, assuming that Christians are persecuted to any degree in the United States. Generally, if a religious minority is persecuted in a country, a member of that religious minority is not holding the senior executive office in that country decade after decade. I mean, I cannot actually think of a U.S. president going back, you know, a century or so, who did not profess some type of Christian faith. Am I right about that, Professor Davis?
You're exactly right about that, and that's why the premise doesn't that Christians are persecuted in any way really doesn't hold. It is understandable that conservative Christians, and we should say that we should point out that not all American Christians feel like they are under siege in this culture. But there are, it is a fairly prominent understanding among conservative Christians that they are under siege, that they are maligned, that they are losing the culture. And there, it's understandable because the numbers of people who profess to be evangelical Christians is getting smaller and smaller in American culture. The number of people who count themselves among those nuns, people who don't affiliate with any organized religion, is getting larger. And in fact, those two groups are statistically proportionally nearly equal these days. And it is fashionable in some circles, certainly in the intellectual circles that I work in at the college. It is fashionable to take pot shots at Christianity, and some of those shots my religious tradition has coming, but that is fashionable. Nonetheless, as you point out, the majority of Americans are still Christian. American politics, if the road to the presidency doesn't, if the road doesn't run through evangelicalism, the shortcut still does. We still have chaplains in state and national legislators that are largely Christian. We still have a calendar that is largely formed by Christian tradition, so it's still a Christian-dominated culture, but it is changing, and those changes, I think, invoke a lot of anxiety for Christians who don't agree with those changes.
Well, Professor, let me pursue this a little more with you, if I could, and just ask, is this really more an issue, not so much of persecution, but of a loss of what had been some pretty steep privileges in the past?
I think that is the more accurate way to understand what's going on. Robert Jones wrote a good book a couple of years ago, The End of White Christian America, in which he argues that what conservative Christians are now experiencing is a loss of, or at least a threat to, their power, their centrality in American culture, especially American political culture. And if you are used to having power, and certainly evangelicalism had a lot of political power in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, if you're used to having that power, when that power starts to erode, and it is far from gone, but when it starts to erode, it may feel like persecution. It may feel like malignment. It's a stretch, I think, to use the term persecution when Christians are, in a sense, just learning what it means to lose the cultural battles a little bit more than we're used to.
Job Tate, a few weeks ago, you contacted me again on another instance of what I think you said was some pretty serious disparagement, if not at least threatened persecution against Christians, and that was the statements by tweets, I guess, by Sean King, the left-leaning activist involved in Black Lives Matter. He's been involved in the Bernie Sanders campaigns, etc. Sean King tweeted about the his idea that statues in churches depicting Jesus Christ as white and stained glass windows, etc., should be torn down. They should come down because it's inaccurate to have depicted this Middle Eastern person as a white European. So I guess my question to you is, do you see that as another sign of this overall problem?
Well, you know, first of all, I'd say persecution can mean a lot of different things. I think in our mind's eye, we tend to view persecution the way it happens in a lot of part of the world, where Christians are actually being put to death and they're being hunted down. You know, I think you probably saw this week in China, or the last week, where the people were ordered to remove images of Jesus and replace them with Communist Party leaders. You know, I think in our mind's eye, we tend to view that as more what we think persecution should look at. And you know, in Newsweek in 2018, they reported that the persecution and genocide of Christians across the world is worse today than at any time in human history. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it depends on how you define persecution. I tend to use the word hostility, and I think of a couple instances. One of the most chilling things I saw from a Christian perspective was in 2017, you might remember this, when Senator Sanders questioned a nominee to be, I think he was for deputy director of the OMB.
Russell Vought, yes.
And he questioned him about his some stuff he'd written in defense of the Christian faith for his alma mater. His defense of his alma mater, Wheaton College out in Illinois.
Right.
And, you know, watching that, he was violating his Article 6 constitutional rights. He was questioning him on his faith. He was saying, do you actually believe that Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation? And if you do, then you are not fit to serve in public office. That's chilling. And, you know, just last year we saw some senators do it. I know Kamala Harris is one of them. She was questioning a judicial nominee for being a member of the Knights of Columbus, which is an organization that is traditionally pro-life and for traditional marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, if you're a part of this group, you are not fit to serve in public life. That's persecution. That is saying you are not welcome to participate in American public life. I don't know what else you'd call it.
A religious test for public office is violative of the U.S. Constitution. Yes, and I thought in the case of Bernie Sanders questioning Russell Vought, and this is when Vought was up for the job of deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Trump administration, sort of the number two budget officer in government. And he had written an article the previous year for a conservative online publication called Resurgent, in which he was addressing a controversy that had come out at Wheaton College in Illinois, his Vought's alma mater. And the professor at Wheaton College had expressed solidarity with Muslims, and Vought wrote that the I don't have the words exactly in front of me, but he basically wrote that because they don't follow Jesus, Muslims, I think he used the phrase, stand condemned. Okay. And if I were Bernie Sanders, I mean, I think Bernie Sanders handled that situation clumsily at best. I think it would have been legitimate for Bernie Sanders to ask him, Mr. Vought, well, if you see Muslims as condemned or any non-Christians as condemned, condemned, of course, according to the scripture, means you're going to burn forever in a furnace of fire. That's in Matthew. Or you're going to burn forever in a lake of fire. That's in Revelation. How can you assure this committee, Mr. Nominee, that you are going to be able to treat people equally as they come before you for jobs in the Office of Management and Budget, as they come before you for, participation in government programs where the OMB is making funding decisions, et cetera. I think that would have been a legitimate question. And I think that Vought actually had an answer for it when he talked about all individuals being made in the image of God and worthy of respect, et cetera. But you know, that is about as far as I think Sanders could have gone. He still would have gotten on the record that Vogt had written this thing that a lot of people do find objectionable, and yet he would not have stepped over that line into the dangerous territory of a religious test for public office. What do you think about that? Am I on track here, Professor Davis, or am I off the rails here?
No, I think generally I would agree with you. I think my reaction to Senator Sanders' comments during that interview were stronger than yours. I think he stepped well over the line. So I agree with Mr. Tate there. I think Senator Sanders was violating his constitutional right and was also, I think, in danger of peddling in an assumption about religious people, in particular Christians, but it's also a version of it is leveled against Muslims as well, that that religious judgment leads to violation of folks' moral and human rights. So I found that a very problematic episode as well. I think there's a big distinction in my mind between Senator Sanders' handling of that his episode and Kamala Harris's of hers, where I think she was, my understanding of what she was doing was asking, what are the moral implications of your association with this group, and will those moral implications have relevance to your service in government? I think, as you've suggested, that's fair game to ask how one would perform one's duties fairly, but to peddle in kind of insinuations that one's religious convictions themselves make them unfit for office, I think is problematic.
All right, let's bring in a caller who's checking in from Montpelier. Jerry, good morning.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
We're doing well. How are you?
Not bad. I have a couple comments and a couple questions.
Okay.
Persecution. Well, number one, all Christians have been persecuted for 2,000 years. There's no question about it. Starting with Jesus. the questions I have are definitions. What is a conservative Christian, and how do you call Easter a holiday? Okay, I'll get off the phone and listen.
Okay, thank you for the call, Jerry. Let's see, I think I use the term holiday to describe Easter. Job Tate, is that a bad thing to do?
Doesn't bother me. I mean, I think we view it as a day of celebration,
mm-hmm.
in our culture. So
yep. And I think holiday originally came from the words holy and day. So seems like that would probably stand up better as a holiday than say 4th of July. I don't know, but
I agree with you.
Let's see. And then the other question concerned that the gentleman's, Jerry's assertion that Christians have been persecuted since Jesus all through the 2,000 years. But our discussion went to this idea that for at least quite a while in the United States of America, Christians were really in positions of power and leadership and so on. It still are. I mean, we just talked about the number two budget officer in the federal government being a very committed and conservative Christian himself, and he's certainly far from the only person of that sort in the Trump administration. So I'm not sure. Did that ring a bell with you, Professor Davis? That this idea that is there an idea extant out there that the Christians have been persecuted pretty much throughout the history of Christianity?
Dave, that's a great example of where a good dose of history can help us. Anyone who knows the history of Western Christianity knows that is not the case, that ever since the Emperor Constantine was converted to Christianity, that Christians in Western Europe and in the United States eventually have enjoyed extensive power. Now, have there been enclaves of Christians who didn't fit with the majority tradition and found themselves persecuted, sure, as 19th century Catholics, for instance. But but Christians have, for millennia, have enjoyed cultural and political power, and certainly in the United States. And as you said, we still do. We still do. It may be eroding a little bit as we become a more explicitly pluralistic nation, but make no mistake, our fingers are all through the political culture of the United States, and it hasn't radically changed.
Some of the negative statements that I hear about Christians, just in general conversation with friends and with professional colleagues and so on, they oftentimes stem from a fear by non-Christians that Christians are looking to sort of impose the tenets of their religion and their will really on people who do not follow their faith. And so there is a certain hostility toward that that phenomenon. Talk to me about that a little bit. What do you think that they are within reason to feel a little put upon when a religion or an organization of religion or preachers of religion which is not theirs try to influence the moral decisions they make in their own lives?
Well, obviously, as a person of faith, I have things that I would like to see be a part of public policy, and but I don't believe in a theocracy by any means. I don't think we should force people to believe in God. But when you think about what we hold to be true in a policy perspective, it's natural for us to advocate for those things. So not all pro-life people are Christians, and not all Christian people are pro-life, but you can't argue that there's a synergy there.
Yeah, significant overlap.
And so, yeah, and we argue them. Our motivation for being pro-life is largely informed by our belief in a creator. But we don't make the argument necessarily from a Christian perspective. You know, we make it from a scientific perspective. We say it's a human life. This is a fetus that's irreplaceable, it's distinct, it's human. But we don't say to people, you need to believe this because God is a creator. It informs our perspective, but it doesn't, it's not necessarily how we argue our beliefs. We don't think we need to do that.
So you would probably get pushback along the lines of somebody saying, you know, that's fine. You're welcome to have your beliefs. We're not maligning you. We're not persecuting you. We're merely saying that we live by a different set of standards, and that we ought to be able to operate by our set of standards, and you operate by yours. If the person speaking is one member of a same-sex couple, they want to get married, that would be something that they ought to do by their lights and probably not by yours, but all of that is okay. Does that not work?
Let me say, you know, for me personally, I don't know why the government's in the business of marriage at all. I think marriage is in the eyes of God, or I don't know why you need a license to get married in this country. That's neither here nor there. But I'll give you an example, Dave. Before I resigned from the legislature, one of the last bills that came up, and I mention this a lot, was a bill that took parents out of the equation while providing certain types of counseling in schools, any age of schools. Any child that was wrestling with some sexual or gender identity issues was able to get mental health counseling without their parents knowing about it. So This is an area where Christians should be outraged and should be deeply concerned, because that is forcing someone's opinion down our throat, and by law you're removing our ability to have you're removing our jurisdiction over our own children because of a worldview that you have. That bothered me so much. I left Montpelier with such a bad taste in my mouth over over that bill. I still, to this day, I get angry about it. And I don't get angry about it as necessarily as a Christian. I get angry about it as a parent, as a Vermont parent, that you were going to say, you know better how to raise my kids than I do, to to the degree that you think I need to be removed from the equation. Now I'm smart enough to know that the reason that they do that is because they are concerned about my faith. They are concerned about Christian parents refusing to allow their kids to see the world a certain way. And they wanted to, and the bill passed. I don't know if a lot of Vermonters even know that. Nowadays, if you have a child in school, that child can be alone in a room alone with another adult talking about their sexuality, and you can't know about it. That's deeply troubling from a policy perspective. But if you're a person of faith, it's very troubling. It's a hostility towards us. They don't think we know how to raise our kids.
You know, we could spend probably a whole show talking about this, but I just very quickly, my sense of that is that suppose a school were to make available counseling for kids who have whatever reason they want to keep the counseling confidential. Let's say the kid is a victim of incest at home and wants to talk to a school counselor about that. Obviously, involving the parent in that situation may not be the way to go.
Dave, you involve the cops at that point.
Yeah, I mean, so the school counselor hears about it from the kid, probably does call the cops, but
they would be required by law to do that.
But can't parents kind of overlay their own views of the world, and including views that are born in faith? Can't they overlay those views on top of, you know, hey kid, here's what you're hearing in school, here's what we think as a family, and here's why we think it, and go from there. I mean, it seems like kids need to learn that they are going to get messaging from a wide variety of sources, and some of them will be family and parents, etc. Some of them will be a secular school environment. A lot of it will be, advertising online, on TV, etc. And so, I mean, there are all sorts of different messages that come in to these kids. Anyway, I sort of digress here. I wanted to wrap this up. Actually, we just have a couple minutes to go, and ask you, circle back to that Sean King incident where he was talking about the removal of white depictions of Jesus, so the statues that depicted Jesus as white. I sort of looked at that and I said, yeah, there's one guy talking, he's got a mouth, you know, I mean, I'm looking and I'm not seeing a lot in answer to the question, has anything actually happened along those lines since he made those remarks a couple of months ago?
There have been some churches that have been destroyed, and I don't know if the motivation for destroying those churches was because of a stained glass window or not, but there has been many examples of, and especially in the unrest this summer, of churches being destroyed. Certainly,
I've heard of one or two cases. I guess there was a fire at the church on Lafayette Square there in Washington before the famous photo op that the president participated in. You're saying there have been many churches destroyed?
Well, there was you might remember at the beginning of the unrest, there was the church that was completely destroyed in Mississippi, which is in the Bible Belt, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I would have to pull up my computer, but there have been other instances of churches, especially in urban areas, that have been destroyed.
James Calvin Davis, professor of religion at Middlebury College, what do you know about this? Has that been a really prominent feature of the unrest this summer, destruction of churches?
I wouldn't describe it that way. I think that the tweet might be factually correct, might even be theologically correct, but I think the suggestion of tearing down statues of Jesus might also just be plain dumb. But it also plays into this assumption that I think is played into some of the last several minutes of our conversation, that there's religion on one side and there is this these kinds of left-leaning social issues on the other side. There are plenty of Christians, and here I would agree with Mr. T, there are plenty of Christians who would say, yes, our faith should motivate our activity in a democracy,
But the question is, what do they think it motivates? And there are plenty of Christians who would say Black Lives Matter and
debates
around immigration and justice for LGBTQ.
Got to go, gentlemen. I hate to do it. We could talk for another hour. But thank you very much, Professor James Calvin Davis of Middlebury College. Job Tate, I really appreciate you joining this conversation. And thank you again. Stay tuned now for the Governor's News Conference on the COVID-19 response. And that's about it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Have a good one, everybody.